Citizen Soldiers, Disc 11.
The crews on the four-engine bombers, nine men plus the pilot, were like an infantry squad in size, but not in rank or function. The four men in the forward section of the plane, pilot, co-pilot, bombardier, navigator, were officers. They were on the offensive. Their job was to deliver bombs on target. Six sergeants were on the machine guns, one at the nose gun, one in the top turret, two waist gunners, the ball turret gunner crammed into a tiny rotating plexiglass sphere that hung below the plane just behind the bomb bay doors, and the tail gunner looking to the rear. When the Air Force leaders learned that the Germans treated sergeants better than privates in POW camps, they made every enlisted man who flew over Germany a sergeant. They were on the defensive. Their job was to shoot down or ward off attacking German fighters. Rank made little difference in the Army Air Force, at least within a crew, where the officers and sergeants were as close to one another as in an infantry squad. They trained together and fought together. The B-17 was dubbed the Flying Fortress. It bristled with machine guns, 1350 calibers in all. So did the B-24 Liberator. The idea was that with all those heavy machine guns blazing away, a bomber could defend itself from any attack. In fact, in 1943, the Army Air Force discovered it could not. Indeed, scientists doing studies for airmen recommended getting rid of the machine guns, the ammunition, and the gunners altogether. Then the bombers could fly higher and faster and would be safer. "No way," replied the pilots. "We want to shoot back." So the guns and the gunners stayed. The pilots and their crews were all in it together. The British, meanwhile, had given up on daytime bombing altogether because of the unacceptable loss rate. So the British bombed by night, huge raids by hundreds of bombers, making no attempt to hit a specific target smaller than a city, while the Americans went in during daylight, huge raids by hundreds of bombers, making every effort to hit a specific target. The B-17 had a top speed of 287 miles per hour, with a range of 2,000 miles when carrying 6,000 pounds of bombs. A total of 12,731 were built by Boeing, Douglas, and Lockheed during the war. The B-24 could carry up to 8,800 pounds of bombs and had a maximum speed of 300 miles per hour, with a range of just over 2,000 miles. By the end of the war, 18,190 had been built. The American pilots and their crews were astonishingly young to be in control of such huge aircraft. Sergeant Robert Hastings was a ball turret gunner on a B-24. In a 1996 interview, he described his fellow crew members. The oldest was the navigator, who was 25 years old. Three men, including the pilot, were 23 years old, one was 21, one was 20, two were 19, and two were 18. They were civilian soldiers with no previous flying experience. Before joining the Air Force, the navigator had been in advertising and was a copywriter. "Four were students," Hastings remembered, "including me. One was a farmer, one was a draftsman, there was a truck driver, a grocery clerk, and a milkman. Three were married, and of the 10 of us, we represented 8 different states." The stress began with wake-up, breakfast, and briefing. In February 1943, Sergeant Andy Rooney, a reporter for Stars and Stripes, went on a mission on a B-17. He stumbled with the officers through the pre-dawn darkness to the briefing hut. The briefing officer stood in front of a wall covered with a blanket. He had a long pointer in his hand. When all were seated, he stepped up to the wall, scanned the room, then grasped the lower right-hand corner of the cloth and threw it back. There was a hush at first as the flyers stared intently at the map. Gradually, a murmur developed, and then gasps as they realized it was a large-scale map of a western sector of Germany. Our destination was Wilhelmshaven. Wilhelmshaven meant flak and terror. Most missions were like that, and sometimes the briefing left men immobile. One navigator was paralyzed by the briefing time after time. His buddies would carry him to the plane. Once aboard, he was okay. Captain Robert Johnson recalled there were three pilots he knew who got a bad case of 109 jitters, referring to the ME-109. Two were useless. The third was trembling and had to be supported as he left the briefing room. "But he was the bravest guy I ever knew," said Johnson, who had the second highest number of aerial victories in Europe. "He was a Jewish boy and built like the Liberty Bell. Narrow shoulders, but a hell of a big butt. He fit the P-47 beautifully. He was absolutely scared to death of flying combat. But he forced himself to, and he did. He flew. He never became an ace, but was certainly there and helped out." The stress increased on the airfield. The men pulled themselves into the planes through an opening in the side. The officers moved from the midsection through the bomb bay, walking on a narrow steel beam, with the 500 or 1,000-pound bombs hanging down on either side. The cockpit in a B-17 was above and immediately ahead of the bomb bay. The top turret gunner was behind the cockpit. To get to the nose area, the bombardier bent down and went under the pilot and past the radio man's position. All this had to be done while wearing heavy coats, gloves, boots. The ball turret gunner's fighting position was in a plexiglass bubble, hydraulically powered, which he moved around with foot pedals. The gunners had silk gloves with electrically heated gloves on top. Every man on the plane was cramped. Whether in the pilot's seat or in the tail gunner's position, once in place, a man could scarcely shift his weight, stretch, scratch, or otherwise give physical release to his pent-up energy. Nor could he close his eyes or otherwise rest. He had to remain at full alert for 3, 4, 5, 7 or more hours. Men took care to drink only one cup of coffee and hold down on the food at breakfast. Lieutenant Chuck Halper had a navigator who needed to go on almost every mission. He carried big paper containers with lids. Despite layers of clothing, parachute harness, Mae West, heated suit, trousers, long johns, etc., he would make his contribution in the containers, slap the lid on, and get dressed. Later, when the bombardier took over on the bomb run, the navigator would hook up to a portable oxygen bottle, pick up the carton, and go back and stand in the bomb bay. When the bombs fell free, he would throw the container out. We were all somewhat flak happy, and each of us accepted his behavior as perfectly normal. We named his special bomb Fliegerscheiße, German for flying shit. With his crew settled in and checking the equipment, the pilot started his engines one by one. The roar of hundreds of engines revving up overwhelmed the senses. Then came the taxi to take off position, then the signal to go. Then the pilots starting down the runway, one right on the tail of another. Lieutenant Les Lennox, a B-17 pilot, recalled 40 years later, "The people in air traffic control today would be absolutely appalled if they could see our only method of controlling all those bombers, taking off at 30-second intervals and climbing through all types of weather, in darkness, while maintaining radio silence. When two aircraft have a near miss today, it makes national news. We had so many each day, we thought nothing of it." Climbing through cloud cover, trying to maintain formation, flying wingtip to wingtip, made for a high pucker factor. Collisions happened. Lieutenant J.K. Havner, a B-26 pilot, said, "On numerous occasions, a 36-ship formation would join up below the overcast and then bore on up through it in formation." He recalled Lieutenant Roy Russell, who was flying number 2 wing position in a flight of 6, when the clouds got so black with rain, he lost sight of the lead ship's right wingtip. He drifted slightly left. His left wingtip hit the vertical stabilizer of the lead plane. That plane, its rudder badly damaged, had to abort. It successfully crash-landed on a farm near the cliffs of Dover. Russell, meanwhile, despite the loss of his wingtip, flew on and completed the mission. "He loved the war," he once told a buddy. "I was young, crazy, and looking for glory." He volunteered for a second tour and flew a total of 70 missions. In 1943, in the first 9 months of 1944, when the bombers got above the clouds and headed east, they were often set on by German fighters rising up from airfields in France. Following the liberation of France, thankfully, the skies were free of the enemy until the flying armada crossed into German airspace. That meant, however, hours of fighting off boredom and tedium in a cramped position, in freezing cold, in an unpressurized airplane at 24,000 feet, taking in oxygen from a tank, staying warm with electric heat in the gloves and boots, with nothing to do but watch for the enemy and stay on the tail of the guy in front. When the bombers approached the target, everyone burst into activity. The 88s on the ground would begin to fire. Their radar told them the bomber's altitude. They set the fuse and then sent the shell up ahead of the formation, where the bombers would fly into the explosion, which sent out shrapnel of considerable size. The Allied countermeasure was to drop chaff to confuse the German radar. The German countermeasure to that was to have a scout plane fly on the edge of the bomber's formation and radio down the altitude. Spreading out and taking evasive action was the natural reaction to concentrated flak ahead, but it was forbidden for 2 reasons. First, to achieve the precision results the bomber generals demanded, the flights had to stay close together and drop their bombs when the lead plane did. Second, to provide the concentrated firepower necessary to drive off German fighters, the pilots had to keep their wingtips in a near-touching position. And from the initial point, IP, to the target, they had to fly slow and steady in parade-like formation, no evasive maneuver of any kind allowed. For the pilots, that went against every human instinct, but they were helpless, because from the IP until the bombs were dropped, the bombardier was in command of the plane. It went where he told the pilot to take it. Sergeant Stan Catarazzole, a ball turret gunner, said, "The worst part is coming in and the flak is busting out. They would just saturate that area with these 88 shells just exploding all around you. Now you have to fly right through it, and the ones that didn't hit you, above or below or beside, you could feel the compression waves from the explosion, and the whole plane would vibrate. Me, being in the ball turret, I was scared shitless countless times. My job was to watch the bomb bay door, and when he hollered, 'Bomb bay door's open,' then I would radio back and tell them that the doors were open. Then I would confirm that the bombs were away. When you got back and saw the holes here and holes there from the shrapnel, you get a sense of how you cheated death every time you went up." Those holes caused by shrapnel and the opening of the bomb bay doors let in a rush of cold air. In the mission Andy Rooney went on, shrapnel clipped off the tip of the plastic nose of the plane, leaving a jagged hole the size of a man's fist. The bombardier, in a moment of panic, tore off his gloves and tried to stuff them in the gaping hole, Rooney remembered. Within minutes, his hands had frozen, and chips of flesh broke off his fingers as they caught on the jagged edges of the plastic. The surgeon of the 95th Bomb Group, Captain Jack McKittrick, remembered gunners coming home with all the skin torn off their hands. Their guns would jam, and in the excitement of battle, the men forgot about how cold it was in those planes and shed their gloves to clear the jam, and their hands would freeze to the bare metal of the machine guns. The B-24s could take an amazing amount of punishment and still fly, and the B-17 pilots claimed theirs were the most durable plane ever built. The B-17s were not fast, they were not maneuverable, they didn't carry the heaviest bomb load, but they were as close to indestructible as anything made by man that can fly could be. Thousands of them returned to England with two or three engines gone, hydraulic systems drained, wounded crewmen on board. Sergeant Catarazol had a fairly typical experience on a mission to Munich. On the bomb run, flak put one engine out of action, then another. "So now we have only two engines, and we are coming in, and we drop our bombs. But when we turn around, we can't stay with the group. Not enough power, so we start falling behind." The captain eased her down to 10,000 feet. "And we were trying to hold that altitude, but we still didn't have enough power, so we began throwing everything we could off the plane. Radio sets, anything that would lighten our load. We threw off our guns, and then the pilot called back to me and said that I had to drop the turret. This huge turret had to go. So I loosened the four nuts on the yoke. There's a big yoke that holds the turret in place. And we are hanging on, and I jump on the turret and kicked it one last time. And the damn thing is just hanging there on this one nut. And the pilot is yelling at me to release it, and I am yelling back that I'm trying." Catarazol gave it one last kick, and it was, "Turret away!" He looked down through this huge hole where the turret used to be, and there, 300 feet below, was the channel. It looked pretty damn close, so I put my Mae West on. I don't swim so good. But the pilot managed to bring her in at a place the English call the Wash, a big, long beach where planes would make emergency landings. In 1996, an 18-year-old student asked Catarazol, "Since you were on bomb runs where you were dropping bombs on people you never saw or ever knew, what were your feelings and emotions when you were doing something like that?" Catarazol's answer could not be improved upon. "First of all, I always thought that I don't want to be here." Sergeant George Hintz was a ball turret gunner on a B-17. On February 25, 1945, he was at 24,000 feet, 8 miles from the target, when the 88 shells began bursting about him. The flak put the number 4 engine out of action. The plane began to lose altitude. The pilot dropped the bomb load over an unidentified town and turned back toward the French border. Enemy fighters attacked. They shot away a part of the nose, and their machine guns made Swiss cheese out of the wings and fuselage. The rear gunner had his gun shot out of his hands. "Then our number 3 engine took a hit," Hintz recalled. "The loud hissing of punctured oxygen tanks below the flight deck and the leaking hydraulic tanks just above those oxygen tanks increased the possibility of an explosion. The number 2 engine caught fire, and flames threatened to explode the leaking fuel tanks. The pilot ordered a bailout. And although we were now at a dangerously low altitude, we all made it, landing near the Swiss-German border, but luckily on the Swiss side. Incredibly, our severely damaged and now pilotless B-17 flew on and made a respectable crash landing in a forest clearing." Navigator Marvin Kraft recalled the time Luftwaffe 50-caliber bullets caused a serious gasoline leak. Fumes were filling the bomb bay. The pilot ordered everyone to get out of the flak jacket, put on a life vest and parachute, and prepare to jump. He dropped the bombs over the North Sea. Kraft was standing over the open bomb bay, looking down into the cold North Sea far below, with my parachute on my chest. I was terrified. It hurt to move, and I was numb with fear. Fortunately, we were able to shut off a valve ahead of the leak, and a pilot got us home safely. On such aborts, we did not get credit for a mission. For all their legendary toughness, the B-17s and B-24s went down in staggering numbers. In the 8th Air Force, 6,537 B-17s and B-24s were lost, along with 3,337 fighters. The life expectancy of a four-engine bomber that didn't get destroyed by flak or fighters was about the same as for a crew, some 35 missions. The record for a single plane, named Rum Dum, was 101 missions. But even when they were war-weary, almost incapable of rising from the ground or being controlled in the air, the generals thought up a use for them. They were stripped down, loaded with 20,000 pounds of explosive, and set out after the toughest targets, submarine pens and V-weapon launching sites. A two-man crew would take the flying bomb to the English coast, where they would bail out over land, and a mother ship would take control by radio signals and guide the pilotless bomber over the sea and onto its target. That was the theory. In practice, several pilots were killed in this hazardous undertaking, including Joseph Kennedy Jr., before it was mercifully called off. For all bomber crews, it was distressing in the extreme to watch B-17s or B-24s explode and disintegrate, or to watch a wounded plane begin to descend, obviously out of control, and to start counting the parachutes as they popped open, hoping to God that the count went up to 10, seldom getting that high. And for the airmen, there was no ceremony of burial, no opportunity to say goodbye to a dear friend. But if they could not gather up his body, they did have to gather up his belongings, and that was one tough moment, back at barracks, sorting through the footlocker of the guy you ate breakfast with, making sure there was nothing in his personal effects that would shock his parents and loved ones. Andy Rooney witnessed a particularly awful death. He was on an airbase in England as a flight returned. The radio was crackling as there were half a dozen bombers with dead and dying men aboard. Then there was a frantic call. The ball turret gunner in one B-17 was trapped. The gears that rotated the ball to put the gunner in position to shoot and then returned him to the position that let him climb out and back up into the airplane had been hit and were jammed. He was caught in his plastic cage. Two engines were out and the plane was losing altitude fast and barely making 135 miles per hour, close to stall-out speed. The pilot ordered the crew to throw out everything. The men started pitching out machine guns, ammunition, oxygen tanks, and every instrument they could tear loose. The pilot opened the petcocks on the fuel tanks to drain them down to the last few gallons. The hydraulic system was spewing fluid. The wheels could not be brought down. A belly landing was inevitable. For 8 minutes, the pilot, the tower, and the ball turret gunner talked on the radio. The gunner knew what was coming. Rooney wrote, "We all watched in horror as it happened. We watched as this man's life ended, mashed down between the concrete pavement of the runway and the belly of the bomber." The pilots, mostly in their mid-20s, were generally admired, respected, obeyed, even loved. A special favorite with all who knew him was Major James Stewart, the actor, already famous for parts in The Philadelphia Story and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Stewart had enlisted as a private, made his way into pilot training school, earned his wings. The Air Force knew he was a good flyer, but didn't want to risk him, so he was assigned to the staff. He insisted on flying. He became a squadron commander. One of his pilots, Lieutenant Hal Turrell, said of Stuart, "He was a wonderful human being and excelled as a command pilot. He was always relaxed with crews, but rarely visited off the base because of his celebrity status and famous face. He would be mobbed by civilians. He never grandstanded by picking missions. If our group led the wing, he flew." Stuart was one of the sensible pilots and thus a survivor. As his fellow pilot, Lieutenant Saul Levine, put it, "Most losses were on the early missions. Survival rates improved with experience, learning how to fly high altitude, close formation, hoarding your gas supply, being particularly watchful during assemblies, all contributed to better survival chances. Keeping rested and laying off the booze before flights also mattered." Missions could be a soul-searing experience. Lieutenant Leo Fenster was a bombardier navigator in a two-engine B-26. He was part of a crew that had survived five crash landings before its 61st mission. Fenster remembered that the last one was the worst one. The crew's mission was to toss chaff out of the plane, which required it to fly ahead of and far below 3,000 feet, the bombers coming on in formation. The German gunners concentrated their fire on Fenster's plane because they knew the purpose of the chaff drop. "Of all the missions," Fenster recalled, "I never incurred the volume and the intensity of ground fire we suffered in this one. The Germans literally threw their entire arsenal of AK-AK. The barrage was so unbelievably intense that for a period of 15 minutes before the dropping of the bombs and 15 minutes after, the noise of the continuous explosions engulfing us was overwhelming. Our plane, for a period of 30 minutes, rocked from side to side and up and down, and frankly, I did not believe we would survive." If one can have a conversation with God during such an intensive barrage, I did, and frankly, I made certain commitments with God which affected the rest of my life in the way I conducted myself. Lieutenant Raymond Murray, a B-17 pilot, recalled a mission against an oil refinery. "There was no ducking anything for us in the box barrages of flak. There was nothing you could do but sit there and say Hail Marys as fast as you could. Planes were going down all around us. But I'll always remember the first one. I was looking right at this plane because I was flying on him when it took a direct hit between number 3 and number 4 engines. I saw the wing rise up in the air. The pilot turned his head very slowly and looked out at me with no expression. Then we saw parachutes spilling out, a couple of them bursting into flames as they opened. Then the plane started cartwheeling and spinning. Not too many chutes got out, possibly 4 or 5. Then the aircraft exploded. And that is when I became a very religious man." Murray was 19 years old. "I was so young that with the passing years, time has erased most of the bad things I'd seen. The only memories that I now have of combat missions are hours and hours of boredom, interrupted by moments of sheer terror. But until that last one, I felt detached. I didn't have anything to do with it. I was never going to get hit." I talked to our flight surgeon, Captain Jack McKittrick, about this one day. He was a very nice guy. He said, "That's why we give you whiskey, and that's why you're all so young. If you thought about it, you wouldn't fly combat." The combat experiences were different for airmen from the ground troops, but there was a similarity in reaction. After 3 months, most infantrymen suffered some form of battle fatigue. For the airmen, that happened after 25 to 30 missions. Still, their commanders kept them in battle. Flight Surgeon McKittrick treated men who had reached, and sometimes passed, the breaking point. "Men would approach me and say, 'Captain, you can do anything you want, but I just can't fly the next mission. I'm too scared.'" He recalled an incident in 1943 when One of our good pilots got hysterical on the truck taking us down to the mess hall. He went absolutely berserk. McKittrick sent such men to a nearby general hospital, where the doctors would use sodium pentothal injections to get the boys to recount their experiences, because a lot of them couldn't express themselves when they were conscious. Getting it out of them was an important form of therapy. In the last week of February 1944, McKittrick's group flew deep penetration raids every day. The boys were getting exhausted, and they were coming home so terrified they couldn't eat or sleep, and then they'd have to get up at 0300 hours and start all over again. McKittrick and some other flight surgeons sent a letter to General Curtis LeMay, CEO of the 3rd Air Division, 8th Air Force, asking him to ease off before the crews broke from shell shock. When he got the letter, LeMay called every flight surgeon in the division to his headquarters. According to McKittrick, "He reamed us out, but good. I can still see him sitting there with a big cigar in his mouth." And he said, "Gentlemen, I know you are professionals, but we are too. I don't want you to interfere with the way we're running the war, and we will not appreciate any more letters." McKittrick saw to it that crews got liquor rations after a mission during debriefing. "It was done methodically," he said, "and it did a great deal to settle them down, and it gave them a little more appetite. It helped to relax them slightly from the horrors of a particularly terrifying mission that all too often surpassed fiction. And I'll be damned if the Women's Christian Temperance Union didn't try their best to put a stop to that." The Allies were putting much of their productivity and some of the best of their young men into the air war, paying a tremendous price in treasure, lives, and physical and mental suffering. It was frustrating in the extreme, therefore, to deal with the fact that night area bombing had not destroyed German morale, and that daylight precision bombing had not destroyed German production. Frustration added to the stress and led to some desperate measures. 8th Air Force Headquarters, unhappy with the results of previous forays, attributed the errors to a shortage of time for the lead bombardier to set his Norden bomb sight once his plane began its run from the IP to bombs away. So the staff ordered the next mission over Cologne to make its final approach upwind. That would slow the planes and give the bombardiers more time. It also gave the 88s a slower target. In the event, the lead plane's release mechanism did not function, so the whole formation flew through the flak without dropping a single bomb. The lead swung around for another go at it. The others followed, fearful but obedient. "We expected hell and caught it," Navigator Frank Aldrich recalled. "Aircraft were dropping out of formation all over the place. And when the bombs failed to tumble out of the lead aircraft for the second time, we wheeled around to form for a third run. But there were not enough planes left for a run, and the lead pilot abandoned the mission. Aldrich's plane badly shot up, dropped its bombs in a field, and made a successful crash landing. There were many aborted raids and screwed-up ones. On the afternoon of March 2, 1945, the men of the 323rd Group, 9th Air Force, set out on a mission to the Zinzsiek Railroad Bridge. The formation consisted of 216 B-26 Marauders carrying 400 tons of bombs and 11 B-26s bringing chaff along. On the bomb run into the target, with bomb bay doors open and the bombardiers keyed to trigger their bombs away when the lead aircraft dropped its bombs, the plane flying on the wing of the leader got a hard flak hit. The concussion caused it to release its bombs prematurely. The rest of the formation let loose when the bombardiers saw those bombs dropped. As a consequence, all 400 tons of bombs landed 6 miles short of the target. The cost to the Americans was one plane shot down, one lost in a crash landing, 8 damaged, and another case of almost unbearable frustration. By the beginning of 1945, most of the 9th Air Force was stationed in France. To keep the Marauders flying over targets in Germany, even in bad weather, the airmen adopted a technique first used by the Germans for night bombing of London during the Blitz. Specifically equipped Pathfinder planes would lead the B-26s. The Pathfinder would follow a radio beam that would take it to the target. Along the way, various radio signals from other stations in France told the Pathfinder where he was with respect to the drop point. It made fairly accurate bombing possible, when everything worked. But it had disadvantages. As Lieutenant Ned Grubb explained it, "The IP was located 25 or 30 miles from the target in order to allow time for the Pathfinder pilot to bracket the beam and nail it down for an accurate run. This resulted in a much longer than usual straight flight path to the target, which was most unpopular with the pilots behind as it provided a better than usual opportunity for the enemy gunners to set up their flak patterns. But it also allowed the Marauders to bomb through snow and cloud. So, as Grubb pointed out, the enemy now had to worry about bombing attacks during rotten weather, a time that up to now was a period of relative relaxation, when they could attend to the maintenance of flak guns, aircraft, etc., and possibly get some rest. If everything worked, of course it seldom did, the system was amazingly accurate. The circle of error was only 300 feet. When the skies were clear enough, the P-47, stationed in France, provided fighter escort for the B-26s. Prior to the bomb run, half of the escorting force would orbit above the bomber formation as top cover, while the other half peeled off to dive bomb the 88-millimeter batteries. At first, this was successful, but the Germans adjusted. They held their fire until the bomb run had begun. The P-47s then had no way of knowing the exact location of the 88s because of smoke, and they couldn't risk getting hit by the falling bombs, so they had to wait until the bombs had hit. Then they would go in again. B-26 pilot J.K. Havner commented, "The courage of these fighter jockeys diving right into the maws of 88s, spewing out lethal shells, is beyond description." Fighter pilots were special. They had swagger, bounce, energy. No more than most airmen, perhaps, but these qualities were on display more often, in the air and on the ground. As one example, fighter pilots downplayed the danger from flak. Lieutenant Wayne Gatlin, a P-51 pilot, remarked that one of those bomber fellows was saying, "Why, the flak was so thick, even the automatic pilots and the bombers were bailing out." Gatlin said he hardly noticed the flak, but when pressed, confessed that, "What's nice about fighters, you can dodge flak easily, whereas the bomber boys can't do it very well, especially on the bomb run." The workhorse P-47s could carry a surprisingly heavy bomb load for a single-engine, single-pilot plane. 6 5-inch rockets and 2,000 pounds of bombs, plus 8 50-caliber machine guns. But the pilots had to see the targets. To continue to operate in bad weather, General Quesada came up with a radar device that would allow his P-47s to bomb through cloud cover. American radar operators in France would track the flight of a group of P-47s. The pilot of the lead ship would follow a radio beam to the target. The radar controllers back at base would tell the lead pilot when to drop the bombs. "We hated this," Lieutenant Philip Wright recalled, "and were furious over the authority given the controllers, safely tucked away from the action. Flying straight and level at 10,000 feet and 250 miles per hour, we were sitting ducks for the Germans' radar-controlled flak, nothing more than lousy bomber pilots." In mid-February 1945, Quesada flew in a four-plane mission with Wright and two others. On the way to the planes, P-47s armed with two 500-pound bombs and ammunition for the 850-caliber machine guns, Quesada said, "Gentlemen, just forget I'm a general." With a grin, he added, "If you can." As the planes approached the target, the radar started acting up. The pilots peeled off, formed up for another run, and were again frustrated by the malfunctioning radar. After four more tries, Quesada scrubbed the mission. So, in Wright's words, "We opted to dive bomb and strafe a panzer division. It was too good a target to pass up while we still had all our bombs and ammunition. Diving down through a barrage of 20 and 40 millimeter flak, I lined up on the target and let fly. My bombs made a great hit, and I hoped Quesada was as impressed with me as I was." He was, and that was the end of the radar-controlled missions. On another mission, Wright had an unusual experience. He got a radio call from a man who identified himself as the ground controller for an armored division. The controller said German tanks were hiding in such and such a wood and asked the P-47s to go after them. Wright and his buddies flew to the wood, where the ground and air erupted. Bursts of 88-millimeter flak were going off everywhere. We had been suckered into a flak trap. The Germans had located the American radio frequency and had a controller speaking with a perfect American accent who had fooled us. The most famous bombing raid of the war against Dresden on February 13th through 14th, 1945, has been called the most barbaric, senseless act of the war. During the night, RAF Bomber Command carried out a raid with 873 bombers, dropping thousands of incendiaries and high-explosive bombs up to 4 tons. This set the city on fire and started a firestorm as the rising column of intense heat sucked up oxygen and burned it, creating hurricane-like winds and temperatures up to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. At noon, 311 B-17s from 8th Air Force released 771 tons of bombs on the flaming city, with the aim of catching firemen and rescue workers when they were out on the streets. The following day, 210 B-17s dropped another 461 tons. The firestorm raged for 4 days and could be seen for 200 miles. In Dresden, people in air raid shelters suffocated or were baked alive. Kurt Vonnegut described the scene in a letter he wrote his parents shortly after the war. "On February 14th, the Americans and the RAF came over. Their combined labors killed 250,000 people in 24 hours and destroyed all of Dresden, possibly the world's most beautiful city. But not me. After that, we were put to work carrying corpses from air raid shelters. Women, children, old men, dead from concussion, fire, or suffocation. Civilians cursed us and threw rocks as we carried bodies to huge funeral pyres in the city." Vonnegut was eventually liberated by the Soviets after their Soviet planes strafed and bombed us, killing 14, but not me. His POW railroad car had earlier been shot up by Americans. Vonnegut says he is the only man to be shot at by Germans, Americans, and Russians, and bombed by the British, and survive. On the 50th anniversary of VE Day, during a discussion of World War II on television among Joseph Heller, Vonnegut, and me, Vonnegut said, "The bombing of Dresden didn't shorten the war by 1 second. There is only one person in this world who benefited from that raid, and that's me." But although Dresden is generally considered to be the most destructive raid in the European war, it was not. Just before Dresden, the Allied bombers had hit Berlin, a 1,000-bomber raid, and Leipzig, even harder. those bombings were feebly protested, if at all. What made Dresden special was its apparent absence of military or industrial targets. People were outraged at the destruction of the heart of a relatively undamaged city, known throughout the world for its beauty. Further, the death toll at Dresden was initially wildly inflated, to as high as the 250,000 figure cited by Vonnegut. The Germans later revised the figure to 135,000. Recent disclosures put the figure at 35,000. No one knows for certain, as Dresden had many refugees in the city. The protest came first from Nazi propaganda, but as soon as the widespread damage in Dresden became known as fact, there was an outcry in the Allied world. British critics of area bombing in general raised numerous questions about the necessity for the raid. Even Churchill, who had helped set the Dresden raid in motion by asking RAF Bomber Command to find more means of harrying the German retreat, backed away. On March 28th, he warned his chiefs of staff of the folly of any bombing of German cities simply for the sake of increasing the terror, and as a result, coming into possession of an utterly ruined land. Why would the Allies want to bomb a commercial city devoid of genuine targets? There are many answers. The one that makes the most sense to me is that the Allies had just plain run out of targets. The cities along the Rhine-Ruhr in western Germany had been demolished and/or occupied by mid-February. Berlin, Leipzig, and other central German cities were rubble. Dresden was one of the few relatively intact cities left. It is not true that Dresden attracted refugees because it had never been bombed. It had been, twice, although in much smaller raids. When questioned by Secretary of War Henry Stimson about the need for the raid, General Marshall indicated that the Russians had asked the Allies to disrupt German communications. There was a significant railroad marshalling yard in Dresden, seeming to put the blame on them. But the Soviets said they had made no such request. But by this time, mid-1945, the Soviets were already creating what would become communist East Germany, and thus had a political motivation to pretend they were the great friends of the common German people, when the capitalists were destroying their homes and families. The British, unjustifiably, got most of the blame. Dresden became something of a mark of shame to the British establishment, as it became the symbol of terror bombing. So much so that General Arthur Harris, commander of RAF Bomber Command, was the sole major British wartime leader not honored with a knighthood. The Americans involved in the raid will have none of that. Lieutenant Dave Nagel said in an interview, "If you saw London like I saw it, you wouldn't have any remorse. I don't know anyone who was remorseful. I didn't hate anyone, but near the end we were nervous, uptight. And as time went on, for me a dead German was the best German. To this day I won't buy German goods, if I can help it. I am prejudiced." Lieutenant John Morris declared, "I am hardly ashamed of having gone to Dresden that day. It was sound strategy to prevent the Wehrmacht from falling back to regroup and be lethal again. So we bombed the hell out of the railroad marshalling yards and road hubs along the Wehrmacht's line of retreat, up and down Germany's eastern border. I don't rejoice at the 35,000 Germans killed there. I doubt there were many Jews in that number. The good burghers of Dresden had shipped them all off to Auschwitz." Morris went on to put the raid in perspective. "It is true that the RAF purposely started a firestorm, causing many of the casualties. It was a tactic they frequently tried. But they and we killed more people in other cities on other days. So did the Russians. So did the Japanese. So did the Germans. Dresden was not unique." 8th Air Force prided itself on its pinpoint bombing and all but denied its role in the Dresden bombing. But from a German point of view, in the last few months of the war, one could hardly tell if those were British or American planes dropping bombs on their cities. Captain Dan Villani of the 398th Bomb Group was a pilot of a B-17 who was part of the massive raid on Berlin in mid-February. Decades later, he recalled that most of the formation spread out to avoid the flak, and in so doing ruined the accuracy of the drop. I'm sure many of the pilots didn't give a damn. They just wanted out of a target area as fast as possible. The aiming point was the center of Berlin, and I don't think this was bombing a military target. But I personally felt no remorse. They brought Hitler to power and supported him, and sealed their fate. From 1943 onward, after he was thrown on the defensive, Hitler had exhorted the German people to hang on just a bit longer. Secret weapons were on the way. Most of that was typical Hitler bombast. The closest he came to a secret weapon that could reverse the situation was the jet airplane, and in a variety of ways, he grossly misused it. His biggest mistake was to insist that the ME-262 be built as a bomber rather than a fighter, a mistake compounded by his insistence on continuing to build conventional bombers. Half the planes produced in Germany in 1944 were bombers. In 1945, it was still 40%. Meanwhile, Germany was losing 82% of its effective strength in the air per month, or a loss rate of about 1,200 planes out of an average strength of 1,300. The jets could have cut those losses considerably, but there were never enough of them. Total production was 1,433, but only 200 or so got into combat, and never more than 25 at a time. These were paltry figures compared to the numbers of Americans in the air. In one March 1945 raid on Berlin, there were 1,250 B-17s escorted by almost as many fighters. The ME-262 and other German jets outclassed all other World War II planes, but they were no more war winners for Germany in the last year of the war than were the V-weapons. If the P-51s could not match the ME-262s in the air, they could shoot them up on the ground or drop their bombs on the telltale extra-long runways the jets required. By early 1945, the jets were reduced to hiding in the woods and using the Autobahn for a runway, or, along with the big bombers, to go after known production sites. Reportedly, some 500 jets were destroyed before delivery to the Luftwaffe. The jets and the V-weapons were cause for worry, and both did considerable damage. But both came too late, in too small numbers, and were so badly mishandled that they could only postpone and make more costly the Allied victory, not prevent it. That does not answer the questions. Was strategic bombing critical to the victory? Was it a wise use of resources? It certainly was costly to the enemy. It is estimated that 2 million people, soldiers and civilians, were engaged either in anti-aircraft defense or in the cleanup and repairs after the bombings. But it was terribly costly to the Allies, too, in resources and lives. America put some of her best young men in those B-17s, and it cannot be said, one way or another, if that was the best utilization of their talents and abilities. As a personal judgment, it is hard to see that the terror bombing of cities had a significant impact on the fighting fronts, or that going after specific factory systems, such as ball-bearing plants, was worth the cost. Where the payoff came, and it was critical, was to force the Germans on the defensive in the air, which freed the Allied armies in Europe from fear of the Luftwaffe, and in the oil campaign, which was such a spectacular success that by the spring of 1945, the Wehrmacht was out of gas. In and of itself, that justified the investment in four-engine bombers. The war could not have been won without them. Chapter 13. Medics, Nurses, and Doctors. It wasn't any different getting killed in World War II than in the Civil War. But if the shrapnel, bullet, or tree limb wounded a GI without killing him, his experience as a casualty was infinitely better than Johnny Reb's or Billy Yank's, beginning with his survival chances. Military medicine had vastly improved in the 20th century. The medical team, from medics in the field to the nurses and doctors in the tent city hospitals, compiled a remarkable record. Over 85% of the soldiers who underwent emergency operations in a mobile field or evacuation hospital survived. Fewer than 4% of all patients admitted to a field hospital died. In the Civil War, it had been more like 50%. Wonder drugs and advanced surgical techniques made the improvements possible. But it was people who had to get the wounded into a hospital before it was too late for the nurses and the drugs and the surgeons to do their work. Those people were the medics. In an infantry battalion of 12 platoons, there were 30 to 40 medics. After time on the line, whether a week or a month, most units were down to one medic per platoon. The medics varied as much in motivation as in size and shape. But a common theme was a refusal to kill, along with a desire to serve. One of the heroes at Point du Hoc on D-Day was Private Ralph Preacher Davis of the Rangers. Asked in September to be transferred to the medical corps for religious reasons, he was accepted immediately, as volunteers for the medics were hard to find. On a night patrol, Preacher got hit in the back by a sniper. He was paralyzed below the waist. After the war, he achieved his ambition of becoming an ordained minister before he died of the wound. Sergeant Frank South said Preacher was deeply respected for his courage, proven in battle, and his devotion, also proven. The combat experience brought forth from Preacher a strong moral reaction. Others had strong responses too, but sometimes in the opposite direction. Preacher couldn't bring himself to kill anymore. Some men who started out as medics because of religious conviction changed on encountering the reality of war. They requested transfer to the line company, meaning they wanted to pick up a rifle and shoot back. The medics had done all the training an infantryman did, except for weapons. In training camp, the medics had been segregated into their own barracks, kept away from the men they were learning to save, apparently for fear of contamination of the real soldiers. The rifle-carrying enlisted men and the medics developed little camaraderie. One lieutenant confessed that he and his platoon mildly despised the men of the medical corps because they were conscientious objectors. Their mere presence cast a moral shadow over what the infantrymen were training to do. They were often ridiculed, called names such as pill pusher or shank mechanics because of the salt tablets they handed out, and the tourniquets and bandages they put on imagined wounds in field exercises were a joke. So was their only real work, treating blisters and the like. But in combat, they were loved and admired without stint. Overseas, medic Buddy Gianoloni recalled, "It became different. They called you medic, and before you knew it, it was doc. I was 19 at the time." On countless occasions, when I've asked a veteran during an interview if he remembered any medics, the old man would say something like, "Bravest man I ever saw. Let me tell you about him." Here is a typical account. Private Mike DiBello got hit by a machine gun bullet that ripped right through the upper muscle of his right arm. Doc Mellon was the bravest kid I ever saw. He came running right through the machine gun fire and put a tourniquet on my arm. Mellon got smashed by the concussion from an .88. His shoulder was out of the socket. He should have gone back to the aid station, but as he later explained, he felt, "There were just too many wounded guys to work on, so I took some codeine and morphine. I couldn't raise my arm beyond my waist, so here I was trying to work on these wounded guys with one hand." To preserve their non-combatant status under the Geneva Convention, the War Department did not give medics combat pay, $10 extra a month, or the right to wear the combat infantryman badge. This was bitterly resented. In some divisions, riflemen collected money from their own pay to give their medics the combat bonus. As to their right to wear the badge, 5 enlisted medics in ETO were awarded the Medal of Honor. Hundreds won silver or bronze stars. Medic Ed Graychick of the 4th Division had earned a bronze star. Later, when his company underwent a shelling in the Hurtgen Forest, one of the sergeants was killed by shrapnel in the neck, and Graychick took a large fragment in the back of his head. He was unconscious and looked gone. Beside him, a third man was screaming for a medic. Lieutenant George Wilson ran to the wounded man and found him frantically gripping what was left of one arm with his remaining hand. The arm was gone, almost to the shoulder. As Wilson stared helplessly, Medic Graychick came to. He told Wilson to get a tourniquet on the man, handed him some morphine, explained how to use it, then gave verbal instructions as Wilson sprinkled sulfa powder on the gory stump and bandaged the wound. As Wilson completed the job, both the wounded man and Graychick passed out. Wilson got a jeep to carry them back to the aid station. They survived. Medics served in the line companies. They were in the foxholes in static situations. But if the Americans were on the offensive, they sometimes had to stay behind with the wounded, feeling lonely and abandoned. On other occasions, when an attack failed and the men fell back, medics had to go between the lines to deliver aid and start the wounded man on his way to the field hospital. Private Byron Whitmarsh of the 99th Division described what it was like for the medics during a shelling. "There are worse things than being a rifleman in the infantry. Not many, but being a medic is one of them. When the shelling and shooting gets heavy, it is never long until there is a call for, 'Medic!' And that's when your regular GIs can press themselves to the bottom of their hole and don't need to go out on a mission of mercy." Once the medic reached the wounded man, he did the briefest examination, put a tourniquet on if necessary, injected a vial of morphine, cleaned up the wound as best he could, sprinkled sulfa powder on it, slapped on a bandage, and dragged or carried the patient toward the rear. Private Robert Phillips, a medic with the 28th Division, came to dread the sound of incoming shells and the invariable "Medic!" cry that forced him to leave his hole. As he worked, shell fragments whittled down the trees and casualties increased. He remembered for the rest of his life the job of examining a wounded man at night, cutting away clothes in the darkness, feeling for the wound. It was like putting your hand in a bucket of wet liver. Private Benedict Batista was a medic with the 90th Division who went the whole way from Utah Beach to Central Europe, trying to save lives. After the war, he reflected, "I don't regret what I did, but if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't want to be a medic. I have seen too much blood. I would want to be in a maintenance outfit in the Army." On his initial mission in the field, Sergeant Gianoloni came near to total failure. The first person that I treated who was wounded happened to be an old, rough and tough sergeant. He had a piece of shrapnel go through his boot and up there by his toes, and it wasn't a serious wound, but to him it was. I sat down alongside of him, and he was moaning and groaning. And I said, "Well, I have to cut your shoe off." And he said, "Well, come on, don't talk. Get me taken care of." So I cut his shoe off, and I'm getting ready to put the bandage on, and I look down, and there is blood all over my hand. So I lean over the side, and I have the dry heaves. And he is getting more aggravated by the minute, this sergeant. He says, "Come on, don't do that." He said, "Take care of me." I said, "I am doing the best I can." The patient was getting nervous, and he was armed and angry. Gianoloni decided to give him a shot of morphine, not because he needed it, but because I didn't want that son of a gun to get all worked up. So I got a morphine packet out of my pouch, and I rolled up his sleeve, and I pushed it in his arm there, and I am squeezing that thing and squeezing it, and he is yelling, and I'm squeezing, and finally the damn thing broke. I said, "Oh, I forgot to puncture the needle." I said, "Oh." Gianoloni threw the packet away. His patient picked up his rifle. And he said, "You bastard, you better take care of me or I'm going to shoot you." I said, "Just one more time." So I got another packet and I punctured the needle that time and I gave him a half grain of morphine. That got him reeling. It should have. According to Gianoloni, 1/16th of a grain is sufficient to knock a man out for an operation. If the medic didn't do the job right and fast, he lost the patient, and sometimes he had to deliver his first aid while under aimed enemy fire, because occasionally Germans would fire at a medic at work between the lines. Private Phillips was wounded while tending to a wounded man. On Christmas Day, Private Louis Potts of the 26th Division was fired on while attending a wounded soldier. He stayed in the snow-covered field and went to work on another casualty. This time, the German sniper got him in the forehead. His sergeant commented, "Potts was small in stature. He did his very best to help the wounded, regardless of personal danger." I've heard dozens of such stories from German and American veterans, usually, however, from a man who heard about such a thing, as opposed to seeing it himself. Albert Caudrey of the U.S. Army's Center of Military History insists that they were uncommon. He points out that careful studies demonstrated that the Germans, by and large, were following the Geneva Convention. Although men wearing their Red Cross armband were shot, sometimes it was because the Red Cross had not been seen. The response of the medics is conclusive. It was to make themselves more visible, not less. They began to wear two armbands and paint a Red Cross in a white square on their helmets. They were confident that most Germans or GIs would respect the symbol if only it could be seen. Caudrey contrasts this with the Pacific War, where medics were special targets of the Japanese and responded by taking off the armbands and even dyeing their bandages jungle green. Lieutenant Wenzel Andreas Borgert commanded an anti-tank unit in the German army in Normandy. He described an American attack in which 10 of his 15 men were wounded. He radioed for an ambulance. "And this much I can acknowledge," Borgert said in an interview, "that at the very second that the big Red Cross flag came over the hill behind me, the Americans stopped firing immediately. I can honestly say that made a big impression on me, because there was no such thing as Red Cross on the Russian front." Both sides tended to their wounded. Borgert noticed an American officer and crossed no man's land to talk. The American opened the conversation in German. "Where did you learn such good German?" Borgert asked. "My family is German," he said. Then he asked Borgert if he didn't want to surrender, as Germany has lost the war in any case. No, Borgert replied, he would continue to fight. But he let the American know that as soon as dark came, he intended to pull back from his present position. Then I won't attack you till dark, the American replied, and it was done. Americans sometimes shot medics. Major John Cochran of the 90th Division recalled a forward observer who would call for a barrage when he knew the Germans were eating. He had a sixth sense about it, according to Cochran. After calling for a ceasefire, he would say, "Get ready to do it again." He explained to Cochran that in 5 or 10 minutes, their medics will come out to treat the casualties, and we'll get them, too. Sergeant Robert Bowen of the 101st recalled that on December 23rd, in the Bulge, 2 men from his platoon were wounded. "They lay in the snow, one babbling incoherently and the other screaming." Bowen tried to get to them, but German fire drove him off. Medic Everett Paget said he would try, explaining that the Germans would honor his Red Cross patch. "He went out there. It was one of the bravest acts I had ever witnessed. Enemy bullets were plowing up the snow around him until he reached the wounded men. Then the German fire slackened and he tended the 2 men, although both were beyond rescue. At least Paget gave them some morphine. Then he returned to the American line and the firing resumed." Bowen confessed, "I thought of the wounded Germans who had lain in the road the day before, and our guys had tried to kill whomever went out to help them." In Normandy on D-Day, +2, Private Ken Webster of the 101st saw a German jeep pop out of some smoke and drive boldly through the village of Vierville. It was flying a large Red Cross flag and carried 2 wounded Germans on stretchers in back, with a big, husky German paratrooper at the wheel. It was so surprising a sight, no one made a move to stop it, until finally, when it was almost out of the village, an American officer stopped it. Webster described the result. "The jeep was commandeered. The driver, a medic, was shot for carrying a pistol, and the 2 wounded men were left by the side of the road to die." Lieutenant Charles Stockel saw medics fight each other. His diary for July 25th reads, "An American medic and a German medic in no man's land, treating the wounded, get into a fist fight. The war stops for 10 minutes until the American clobbers the kraut." On one occasion, a medic inspired a company to seize an objective. Captain Colby's company was on the Ore River during the Bulge. Colby told his men to attack across the frozen river. They did, but were driven back by a machine gun. All but 1 man made it back to the American-held bank of the river. He was a casualty. As Colby related the story, "He lay still in the middle of the frozen river. A medic, I am pretty sure it was Vosburgh, left the pitiful concealment on our bank of the river and made his way to the fallen man's side. The machine gun opened up again. Spurts of snow flew up from the burst, which were falling around the 2. The medic got to his feet and stepped across the wounded man, thus placing himself between the machine gun fire and the casualty. Lying in the snow, he began tending his patient. With that, the rest of E Company headed across the river to the far side, each man banging off a few shots as he went. The wounded man survived, and the attack was a success."
This ends Disc 11.